Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Welcome back, everyone. My name is Renee Powers, and today I'm interviewing Francina Simone, author of the brand new young adult novel Smash It, which is, it's really just a fun read, especially for all of us former theater kids. In this interview, we discuss a whole lot of things, including the hypersexualization of Black women and girls, discovering strong female friendships in literature and in our own lives, how Othello and Shonda Rhimes inspired her new book, some thoughts on why J.K. Rowling is turf trash, and why reading diversely doesn't necessarily make you a cultured or better person. I love this conversation. But before we get to that, I do have a bit more to share about our November box. I announced last week that in honor of our theme, Native and Indigenous Voices, we're reading Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer. I'm thrilled to share that the author herself will be joining us for our discussion. Now, we don't have a date pinned down yet, but we will let our members know as soon as we do. And as always, our discussions are for members only, so maybe you've read Braiding Sweetgrass and you'd like to attend the event, you can actually join us at the virtual membership level to get access to our discussion groups and video calls. But if you are not a member yet, may I suggest that you join this month and get the full subscription box. Because we are also featuring four Native woman-owned businesses in our November boxes, and the first is called Sakari Botanicals. We'll be featuring Sakari Botanicals' gorgeous, gorgeous bath scrubs for your next long soak. Subscribers might get one of these three scents: wood rose, cedar lavender, or my favorite, sweetgrass. Pair that with, I don't know, a piece of the Bedre chocolate that members will also receive in November. And you've got yourself a delightfully indulgent evening of self-care, which I imagine, no matter what, we're all going to be needing that in November. We'll announce the other two featured businesses and items next week on the podcast, but you may also want to keep an eye on our Instagram. We always share sneak peeks there. As always, you will find everything you need in the show notes or check out our website, feministbookclub.com, for our shop and membership options, our blog, and all the podcast show notes. Now, here is my interview with Francina. Hi, everyone. I am so thrilled to be talking with Francina Simone today. Francina is a conscious being trying to uplift the world one conversation at a time. Smash It is her up-and-coming debut. It's actually out now, about a girl throwing caution to the wind to discover who she is and what it really means to love. I am so thrilled you're here, Francine. Francina, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here, too. And don't worry, everybody always calls me Francine.
It's the Simone at the end. Okay, so we start with the same question to everybody. What does it mean to you to be feminist?
Ooh, I actually had to ask myself that recently because I never, like, for the longest time really considered myself feminist, only because I never really saw a place for me in feminism. It felt like such a white space, and I just felt more like I already have to work on these things just as a Black chick, like, you know, like being seen fairly or like being taken serious or being X, Y, and Z. And so I never really considered myself a feminist. But then, like, as I started looking back on it this year, for the most part, I realized that I just realized that being a woman is being a feminist. I feel like just like being Black is a political statement these days, like being a woman is a political statement. And everything that I do and everything that I say or think, because even if you don't think you're a feminist, it's like you just existing is an example of womanhood if you are woman facing, right? Like it's an example of it. And therefore you are moving throughout the world in a way as a woman. And that is making a statement on feminism, on who, what it means to be a woman. Because I mean, like every woman says that whether they want to or not. So.
Oh my gosh, that was such a good answer. I mean, and you're touching on intersectional feminism already, and that you can't untangle your Blackness from your femininity. It's one and the same.
Yeah. And like in a lot of different ways, and I actually touched on this on Smash It, in a lot of different ways, I feel like being Black and a woman is automatically super sexual. Because even at a young age, there's verbiage, there's, I've experienced at a young age, just being like, and I have to say, I am probably the most traditionally prudish person most people have ever met when it comes to like my knowledge on sexual things, all of this, like literally growing up, I used to do this thing, you know, where you like, you hold up a peace sign and you put your like tongue between it. I thought that meant like making out, like French kissing. I used to go around being like, oh, you guys are going to French kiss. I used to do that. And he was my best friend way back then, but he's my husband now. And like one day I did that to his sister, who was like 3, because I was making fun of her saying that like she liked this other guy and they were going to be doing this. And she was like, in 9th grade, while I was joking around doing that, and I was also at their house, their dad was there, and I was doing that, and they were looking at me like, what? And I was like, it means French kissing, and they were like, you're in college, what do you mean that means French kissing? Like, who are you even? And so like, because I'm so sheltered in that way growing up, it was always so shocking to me how the outside world, like men, it didn't matter the race of people, the gender, people would always talk about me and my body in such a sexual way. And I would just be so, so deeply uncomfortable. I mean, like literally the girl who thinks that it means French kissing, like this oral sex sign. It disturbed me and I never understood why. And the fact that my body, I got curves early on. I was in the 6th grade. Like I remember the 5th grade, I used to shop for clothes in the junior section or like the kid to junior section. And I got these shorts and these tank tops. It was really cute. We didn't have like dress code as strict as it was back in elementary school. And the way that it looked on me just did not look the same way as tank tops and shorts looked on other girls. And I just thought, oh my God, I'm fat. Like that must be it. I have to buy bigger clothes to cover my body up. And it was just me. I was starting to develop all of these curves and I did not know what to do with them. And I was terrified half the time because I just did not know what it meant. And I just, and it took me in adulthood realizing that me with curves was quite a bit different than like my white counterparts, or like I used to have a ton of Asian friends in middle school, and some of them had curves, some of them didn't, but even then they were approached differently than I was. It looked at differently, talked about differently, even by like teachers. And it was just so unnerving. I knew early on that I could not be in a room alone with a male teacher. Like it shocked me that other kids, other girls especially, just were comfortable doing that. And I was like, no, because there were always those slight innuendos and that slight energy change that slight kindness that's just a little different than usual. And it just made me so uncomfortable. And I didn't know, because I was such a kind person. I said I was, like I'm not anymore. But just like, I mean, like I'm bubbly, naive, like super happy. And I didn't realize that sometimes that came off to male teachers and stuff like that as me being inviting of, and like that kind of energy. And it just used to scare me. Like, but like I realized that a lot of my other counterparts, I'm saying that it didn't happen to other girls regardless of race and stuff, but it took a while longer. Like these things would happen in high school to a lot of girls. Well, it was already starting to happen to me in middle school. And I don't know, it took me a long time to realize that that had a lot to do with just me being Black and how Black women are viewed as like sexual bodies, not necessarily as romantic beings or just like children, or you know, it's like a Black girl is a whole thing. She's not just a little girl. And yeah, took me a while to realize that.
You've written this book, Smash It. It sounds like there are a lot of echoes of your teenage years in here as well, and maybe what you wish somebody would have said. Or can you tell our audience a little bit about this book?
Yes. So it's so funny that you said that there are echoes. Any of my friends who read it, especially the guys, they're like, so which one am I? so funny. And I'm like, neither one, go away. Like, these are their own people. Please stop. And everybody always immediately thinks that I'm Liv. And it's like, just because we're both neurotic does not mean that we are the same person. Me and Liv make drastically different choices in life. So please stop. But this book, oh, it's my heart song. It's about a girl who literally is, she's kind of done with being lame and kind of holding herself back. It's kind of a play on the idea of, you know, like the girl, you take off her glasses and all of a sudden she's pretty. Like, I always used to think that that was so stupid growing up, you know, in those movies, like she's all that. She takes off her, it's like she was pretty when she had on glasses. Uh-huh. What are you guys talking about? Uh-huh. But I really wanted to explore the girl who knows that she's cool, who knows that she has a lot to offer, but for some reason, she just doesn't know how to go about doing it. And it's all about insecurities. Like, we hold ourselves back on everything in life. We are so concerned with what we think our friends think of us, what strangers think of us, what we think of us, our family, all of these different constraints that we kind of put on ourselves because of our own insecurities and just confronting them. We really stop ourselves from standing out and shining. And so she decides that she's going to do it. And she makes this bucket list. And the first thing is like to do something bold. And she's going to like try out for the school musical because she loves musicals. And she's, you know, like her friends are on stage as musicians and they're like, they're really good like actors and stuff like that in their own way. And she wants to do this and her friends end up deciding that they want to do it too, which really pushes her so forward into it. And then like shenanigans just go underway because she's also dealing with crushes that she has on like one of her friends and like the implications of that, seeing herself in a completely different light, starting to see herself as other people really see her, not just how she thinks people see her, and realizing like the difference between illusions and reality. Plus, she goes through something that I think a lot of girls relate to. And it's like, I'm not like other girls. Mm-hmm. We all talk about that and we all make fun of that. But it's real. Like, a lot of girls feel that way because society says what a girl is like. We watch TV shows on what girl friendships are like. And you get deluded into believing that that's what you have to be. And you're like, well, I'm not like that. I'm special. And every other girl's like saying the same thing. And like, I explore like sisterhood and what it means to like when you gravitate towards having boyfriends, not realizing what you're missing out on and like the kinship that comes with that, the understanding. Like, I just wanted to explore all of those things. So essentially just like what it's like growing up when you definitely want to have sex, you just don't know how to go about it. You definitely want to be bold, but you just don't know how to go about it. And you just have to confront all of the demons in your closet as you have them to just like step out and like shine.
I mean, I felt so just a kindred spirit with Olivia. I feel like as a former theater kid myself, we were definitely like the most sexually active group in high school. And wanting to be friends with just boys and you know, coming into a friend group that was mixed gendered and learning to like enjoy the company of other girls. Like, that was, I don't know. There's a lot in this book that I felt was, it felt like I was being seen even as a Midwestern white girl, you know?
Yeah. Because I mean, like, those things are real. And I also wanted, like, I wanted to make sure that people could realize that like an American experience. And I think I talk about this a lot on like my YouTube channel and stuff, but an American experience isn't just a white experience, but because so much media shows that only white people have a basic American experience and people of color have struggles, that we forget that like all of these things we deal with, and you don't have to be black, but you know, sometimes being black means that some things are colored differently, but not necessarily what it's like being with a group of girls and for once realizing like it's not a competition. Like, this is actually pure love. Like, I am in, like, this is just love. And like, you know, really realizing that and being like, wow, TV, like misogyny has really painted a picture of what this should be like. And that's not it. Like, I think most women can really relate to that regardless of, I wouldn't say regardless of region. I think it's an American thing specifically because in other cultures you have, in other countries you have different cultures regarding like sisterhood and stuff like that. But like, especially in America, I think most women in America can relate to that in some fashion or another.
Yeah. I want to go back to talking about, okay, two things. This, the first chapter, I think she reads Shonda Rhimes' The Year of Yes, which such a great book, and it inspires her to make this fuck it list. And we have to like repeat that to the audience. It's not a bucket list. This is a fuck it list, which I thought was brilliant. Where did the idea for the fuck it list come from?
So like I literally did read the Year of Yes like months before this because I was on a memoir kick. It is. And I was like, oh my God, Shonda Rhimes, I'm going to be like you when I grow up. And I just remember sitting down and I've had the story of Smash It in my mind forever. There's a Christmas scene and I know you know what it is. And that scene played in my head, I'm going to say years ago. It's just these three people and this thing happened. And I was like, what happened? Like, how did this get this way? Because I knew that they were all friends. I knew it was, I was like, oh my God, like you don't come back from this. And so I knew that scene for such a long time. And I even knew the characters, like really, I knew them, but I just had no idea what the story was. And then all of a sudden I read The Year of Yes and I was watching Insecure. I had watched Love, Simon. I was watching all of these things that really pulled me back into what it felt like to just exist and like you're seeing the world as it is and you feel like the world is against you, but it's just you being against you. And I just remember like, I was just sitting there and I was like, ah, oh, you know what would be great? Like if Shonda Rhimes, except for like, it's kind of old lady, but like a fuck it list, like people just need a fuck it list and put things down and challenge themselves to get over themselves. And then like, as soon as I said that, like that scene came back and I was like, oh, how did she get from that to that though? And then like, it just all started to tumble in from there. But yeah, Shonda Rhimes really did. I gotta hand it to her. She's the inspiration for the fuck it list, her Year of Yes.
And this is a modern retelling of Othello. Why did you choose that play? What are some of the themes that you've borrowed from? And even Othello is they're doing a rap musical version of Othello, which I just love that so much that that's what the play that they're putting on at the end of the book. So tell me about that.
So I figured out who the characters were, what the situations were, but I realized I had no structure. And this is when I don't know what I was doing, but I was sitting down. And I was like, what if I just make it a retelling of something? And I was like, oh, that's stupid. I hate retellings. I was like literally mulling over in my head. And I don't know what it was, but I saw something on TV and I saw Othello. And Othello used to be my absolute favorite Shakespeare play because I love the villain. I thought he was just so demented because there's so many layers to it. His name is Iago, which sounds an awful lot like ego. And he plays on people's egos and their illusions and their perceptions of reality to really pit them against each other and to essentially turn Othello from a very stand-up person into someone who is possessed by like jealousy and he can't see reason. Like there is no evidence and he is so 100% sure to the point where he smothers this woman that he absolutely loves. And there's just so much like also layered in there, racism and the way that things are said. And I always loved the idea that with Shakespeare, because we can't see it the way that it was originally intended for stage, we don't really know like how these tragedies actually played out. Were they sad? Was it a commentary on racism or was it just like casual, like commentary? Like there's no racism here. This is just how these people are. You know what I mean? Like you really don't know. And I just loved all of those ideas. And I was like, oh man, one day I should write a retelling of Othello. And then like this story came back in where I saw the Christmas scene and I was like, oh, God, that is a climactic moment when things go awry and it all just started to fall into place from there. And I was like, it's gonna be a musical. And I was like, because you know, I also love musicals, and I was like, and they're just gonna do Othello. And I don't know, like as soon as I realized that, I sat down and I started to actually script out Othello, but kind of write out the outline of Othello, because I was like, is there any way that I can actually make this a retelling instead of them just doing the musical and it being kind of thematic? And as soon as I did that, all of the scenes of what was happening in her life just started to flow on the page. And I just started to see like how each scene just like really a mirror of what happens in Othello, except for instead of it being traditionally like there's a bad guy, there's a good guy, and there's all these other characters, it's like every character is a member, is like all of Othello, the entire cast in themselves, because at the end of the day, there's no hero. There's no villain. We are all of those people. We are the jealous wife who goes along with it because we just, you know, kind of don't know how to stand up and say no. We're the naive, like, heroine who just believes in the good of like somebody who's clearly got all these red flags going. We're the villain of somebody else's story. We're the hero of our own story. And at the end of the day, it's always our personal egos that are our downfalls in any given situation. And so there's definite situations where you can see, like, oh, this is definitely something that happened in Othello, the way that it happened, how it happened. But for the most part, you're like going along the story, and it's just seeing how people's egos really feed into a narrative that changed the perspective of either how Liv sees things, how another character sees the situation, and how the miscommunication happens. And like, I literally took all the themes in Othello and put them in there. I think there's like brotherhood in Othello, but I turn that into sisterhood. There's jealousy, there's perception and illusion, and how like we can alter what reality looks like for people. Because that's one thing I love about Liv. And I always want people to know this. She's not a character you can just insert yourself into. Like, she's her own person. And you see how her reality can be warped, how she warps it based off of the things she thinks she's understanding and seeing, because she refuses to, and then there's miscommunication, communicate how she really feels in a situation where someone is trying to, kind of, but she's not, so they're not. So now we've got this warped perception of what's going on. So like, yeah, it all came from just me like seeing, I think it was an ad for Othello on like YouTube or something, or like a recommended video. And I was like, I love Othello, blah, 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 blah. It all stemmed from that. And the next thing I knew, I was scripting out like the whole play. And that's why it's also split up into like five acts. So you can really, if you're familiar with the play on a deep level, you can kind of see the echoes.
And if you're not familiar with the play, which I'm not really, like, I know kind of the bones of what it is, you're not missing anything either. This is still a fun romp that you don't need to know Othello intimately to enjoy this book.
Yeah. I always say Othello is like the ghost in the room. Like, if you know the ghost is there, you're like, you know why something moved. But if you don't know the ghost is there, something just moved and you weren't even aware of it, and it is what it is.
And it's still great. It sounds like this story and these characters have been with you for a really long time. And it was like a flame or a spark that, wow. I don't want to make a wildfire joke right now, but
oh my God,
Jesus,
yeah.
That's where I was going. Anyways, it set you down this path of writing this book. Have you always wanted to write, or did this story just like, it just needed to be told?
You know, I decided I was a writer, I want to say like my third year in college. I started out writing back when I was like 17, and I wrote this book in like the heat of the night. It wasn't a whole book, but it was like a good chunk of something. It was just, you know, one of those like fever, like writing, like moments where you look up and it's 7 o'clock and you're like, I have to go to school, but I'm not going to, I'm just gonna be sick today. So I've always wanted to write. And I always say I'm a storyteller because I do so many other creative things, and I've like self-published 2 other books before. And I've always been a storyteller. But I want to say that being able to tell this story was the first time that I finally realized it's okay to be Black and write stories about Black people without it having to be about Black people, or like without having to educate someone on what it's like to be Black, without it being a struggle book or being like, you know, you have to understand, like, this is what it's like. Because I was like, you know, for the most part, I don't even relate to a lot of struggle books. I don't want to say it's because I don't have those struggles. It's because like, for, I would honestly say probably for most Black people, we internalize a lot of trauma. So when we see struggles, we're like, nah, that's just normal. Like, like we don't like go camping out in the middle of the woods in the secluded like cabin area, which may be fun for most people, a getaway. To us, it's like, well, if we have to go grocery shopping, it's a small town, depending on the area. If there's racists, they could, you know, they're seeing us, they probably know where we are. How are we going to get help? Do we call the police if something happens? What if the whole area is somewhat racist? We might not get help. Like, we're thinking of all those things. So we just don't, you know what I mean? But we don't think of it as like, the trauma, like I have to stop and I have to think about the struggle. Like, we don't do all that. We're just like, nah, that ain't for me, sis. Like, I'm not going to secluded area, y'all go ahead, bye. You know what I mean? So it's like, when I read those books, I'm just like, well, this is depressing. Also, this isn't for me. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and I hadn't read a book about a Black girl that was just a rom-com like ever, to be totally honest, in the young adult section. Not to say that they don't exist. And there's so many more now as my book's coming out, but it just was not normal. And even when I did, sometimes it felt whitewashed, which I know can happen during editing, not necessarily in a way that's like because of negativity. It can just be that someone doesn't understand the cultural nuances of a situation. And if you're an early writer, you can honestly think, oh, maybe I didn't do this right. Or this person, you know, this editor could be right about X, Y, and Z. Maybe it doesn't make sense. Maybe it's not going to reach an audience. Maybe I need to change it to be more like this, just because you're thinking from a writing perspective, when meanwhile, it was a cultural misunderstanding. And so it's like, when I do read some books, it's like, it's not, you know, it doesn't quite hit. It doesn't feel just like young, modern, and American and Black. It feels either like a struggle or whitewashed. And this was the first time where I realized that I can use my actual voice, not something that is turned into something else. And I used to stay in fantasy so often because that's where I felt like I could have Black characters because they weren't African American. They were whatever the culture is in this fantasy secondary world. So I can explore that. There's room for that. But this is the first time that I was like, yeah, I can do that in contemporary and it's going to be fun. And I feel like I have to give it to Issa Rae for Insecure, the HBO series, because I've been following her since she was on YouTube with doing the Awkward Black Girl, the web series. And she honestly gave me the ability to step out and be like, yes, I can like, and if nobody likes it, I don't give a fuck. Like, that's just it. Like, we're going to do this. It's fun. I enjoy Insecure so much because I relate to it. And I was like, I want to read something like that. So I'm going to write it.
I love that. I love that answer. You're touching on something just now. I just watched your YouTube video. You are a BookTuber. You've got over 30,000 subscribers, plus me. And you just posted something about reading to be cultured. And I thought this was so good. And I don't want to cannibalize that content. I want our audience to go over and watch that content because it is so good. But can you just give a snippet of that video especially and the kinds of content that you post on BookTube and your BookTube experience? I want to hear all about BookTube.
Yes. Okay. So I'll first talk a little bit about that video. I recently have been thinking an awful lot about how people consume diverse media in general, and not just like people who aren't a part of the group that they're consuming, but people who are. I've been thinking about how everybody consumes diverse media, whether you're white and just like realizing that white supremacy is a thing, whether you're like a person of color, whether you're part of many marginalized communities, you know, like if you're a person of color and queer, whether you're non-binary and white or whatever, right? Like, so many of us are starting to wake up and realize that life isn't necessarily what we thought it was. Like, you can be fluid. Like, everybody's a little gay. You know what I mean? Like, it's we're like, wow, we're starting to really realize things. But when we consume media, I feel like we're still kind of in the dark about one, why we consume diversity. Like, some people, I think, consume it in order to see themselves or to be able to be represented where they were not previously, like with me and wanting to write my book. And then there are people who consume it because they want to be cultured. They don't want to consistently be the person who is just naive and in a box. And I was saying, reading and consuming diverse media does not make you cultured. It makes you aware, and we need to understand the difference between them, because being aware is being able to say, I know that my perspective is not it. It's just mine, which really sets you up to not put your foot in your mouth or to like lean into stereotypes. It sets you up to question everything. Whereas thinking that you are cultured because you consume and you know things about other cultures sets you up to fail. It puts you yourself on a pedestal, first of all, above others, because now you think that you're better. But two, it also sets you up to believe that whatever you've consumed from a different culture was enough of a building block for you to understand that culture. And it's like, you're never going to understand somebody else's culture, not natively. You're only going to understand what the product of the culture that you see. So for instance, if somebody's Jewish and they have a bat mitzvah and you go, that doesn't mean that you're cultured. It doesn't mean that you know anything about it. Just because you listen to some Hebrew, you know, and somebody read from the Torah and you like, you work, you understand a little bit of it and the translation is, you know, some of my friends are Jewish and I I just know these things. Like, just because you know that does not mean that you know what it natively means to be Jewish, because when you grow up that way, it's totally different. These are just products. These are products that other people can see, but culture is something that no one can see. It's a relationship. It's a relationship between two people of it, and how they communicate and how they understand the world and how they protect each other, or how they stab each other, or how they, you know, get angry or love, or all of those things, and how they move about that. That's culture. And you cannot see it. You can only experience it. And that's, so like my whole idea was like, it's interesting to me that we read these things and we end up thinking that we're cultured. So we think that it's okay for us to pass judgment on others for not being understanding or knowing. And then we end up doing the thing that we think they do. We end up acting in ignorance while yelling at somebody for being ignorant. And then we end up assuming so much about that person and whatnot. And it just, it boggles my mind. But to talk a little bit more about my BookTube channel, the reason why I started it originally, because I did not know where to go as a kind of like an author who liked books and like talking about books. And I just so happened to see it on YouTube. Like, all these people were talking about books and it was so much fun. And for like the first 3 months, I had fun doing book tags and just like, these are the books I had bought. And then I realized that things were really superficial and kind of shallow. Not in a bad way. I really do enjoy when people just talk about what they love and how much they love things. But I was like, you know, some of these books are kind of bad, y'all. Like I don't even mean subjectively. I mean, like, objectively, the plot has a hole. Are we going to talk about it? You know what I mean? And I wanted to have these deeper kind of discussions and talks. And then I realized the more I posted stuff like that, the more people I found doing it and the more people started engaging in it. And then the more toxic those engagements kind of started to become. And I remember once I posted a video called like, it was one of my first diversity videos. And I think it's like why we don't need diversity. And it's, we do. It's just, it's one of those clickbait titles. But I had that title and I was making this argument that we don't need diversity for diversity's sake. We need representation, not somebody to sprinkle in a few Asians and be like, oh, look, it's diverse. You know, like we don't even explain which Asian they are, but look, you know what I mean? Like how we don't need that kind of whitewashing and stuff because it's not real. And it's also offensive. And so the whole video is about that. And I just remember like it all started when I realized that I talk about controversial things and in the community, I'm not necessarily arguing against people who are racist or trying to change their mind. My video started to become about changing the minds of people who believe the things that I believe, but did not ever consider nuance or empathy in these arguments and how we're kind of tearing down our own like community for some purity belt on who's most cultured. Because I posted that video and it was actually, she's a prominent author, I would say. And I did not know this at the time because she wasn't very prominent at the time, but she was a big speaker on diversity and diversity topics. On Twitter, actually two of them, on Twitter, they kind of were saying that my video was the opposite of what it was, that I was speaking out against diversity because I thought that, you know, like people who wanted diversity were just like, you know, crying for no reason and that we didn't need diverse books, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember being like, oh, well, maybe that's just a misunderstanding. Let me like, you know, like they're subtweeting me. I didn't know what subtweeting was back then, but I was like, well, let me like, you know, try to clear up understandings because I'd hate to be misunderstood. And as soon as I start tweeting and we're going back and forth, it comes out that they never even watched the video. And I was like, so you want me to clarify points on a video that you haven't watched? And that was the last conversation I ever had with those two authors, because I was like, this is kind of ridiculous. Like, how are we, from then on, my whole BookTube channel became about pointing out how we should be informed before we get enraged and how we should at least seek to understand context and nuance and practice empathy. So we don't end up looking completely stupid, because how can you ask someone to clarify anything when you haven't even read the text? And then I just started noticing all throughout the book community and the more toxic areas, how people really wanted to argue about and have discourse, good discourse, but they weren't even consuming the content to have discourse to begin with, and how important it is to really know what it is that you're combating and why. And how we can talk about those things without actually tearing people down or accusing people of acts that aren't inherent, because we can talk it like everybody's a part of white supremacy. If you live in America, like it doesn't matter who you are, you are, because you are part of that system. If you participate in anything that has to do with any type of media, any type of talking to other people, right? Like, it's just, it's like the air you breathe when you don't realize it's toxic, you know? And it's like, so if everybody is practicing this, then maybe we shouldn't like gut each other when we all want for something better. We should literally just have discussions instead of like these enraging blow-ups where we all yell and either you're on this side or you're not. And it's like, first of all, I want to formulate my own opinion before I pick where I'm going to stand. And when I pick where I'm standing, it's going to be with myself and my opinion. Everyone should only stand with themselves and their opinions. It should not be about sides, because that sounds, I don't know, a little sus to me. So that's like my whole BookTube channel in a nutshell.
I love this because it's bringing so much nuance to conversations that, like you said, tend to be black and white, tend to be one side or the other. And that's something I'm realizing more and more and more and more, is that there is no hard and fast truth to anything. There is always nuance. There is always a little bit of this and a little bit of that and a little bit of that. And also like shit we haven't thought about yet.
Yeah. And like, and I always explain to people, just because there's nuance doesn't mean, or you take nuance into consideration, doesn't mean you give someone a pass. It just means you're better informed on how that person got to where they are. So you know whether it's like how you can actually go about changing somebody's mind or explaining perception. Like, I don't know if you've realized lately about J.K. Rowling and
she's
her whole turfy like behavior, like, oh my God. Like, but she just like, somebody announced recently, like she has a new book coming out about a cis man who dresses as a woman and he's a serial killer and he does it to kill women. And it like, I was just like, I don't understand how you would make up a scenario in which to prove a made up point. Like you're literally like, and I stopped for a minute because I was like, nobody does this without thinking that they're actually doing some right. Right. Like she's not just crazy. And so why is it, for a minute, I had to think like, why is it that like in the UK, there are so many turfy women like this? And I had to stop. And once I realized, oh, historically, they're totally different than America. Here, queerness is more centered in femininity stereotypically. And you can also find, and especially when it comes to queer men specifically, you see stereotypically a lot of people believe them to be more feminine. It's not centered in masculinity. Whereas if you look historically in the UK, queer men still are centered in masculinity, like in a lot of the older works and stuff like that. And I mean, like, I'm talking about like how boomers look at it, not like the modern age, right? But like boomers who are reading like Charles Dickens as like modern literature novel, but you know, like the canon was canon, you know what I mean? And if you look at like the work of like D.H. Lawrence and some of the older authors, when they talked about queerness, it was like men being men and wrestling naked, and it's men. And like you look at Hemingway, who I don't know, and I don't think that Hemingway's queer, but he has a lot of queer knit, like to me, his work have a lot of like queerness that you can explore, but it's in a very masculine way. And he wrote and was very based in Europe an awful lot because he was in the war there. And so I was thinking about this and I was like, you know what? I bet you, and this is just a hunch, in the UK, because they're so centered in whiteness, women there who are white women who believe themselves to be feminist, but only believe that femininity is a thing in which you can be born into if you have certain genitalia, those white women believe themselves to be the epitome of oppression because their everyday life is so centered in whiteness that there's no intersectionality going on, because in the UK, they don't even really recognize the racism that happens. They're always like, those people in America are so racist. You know what I mean? And it's like, let's talk to all of the brown people there. But you know what I mean? Like they don't even really recognize it that much. So let alone the intersectionality. So they're not like consistently having to question their own victimization plus their own predatory behaviors and to other groups. So they're centered in victimness, one, and they believe that their true struggle is just misogyny. So it's man versus woman. So they see man as masculine, woman as feminine. And therefore, if there is a man who believes he's a woman, they see that as literally a man who is wanting to dress as a woman, not as somebody who literally is a woman, because gender isn't real. Like y'all, like, can you imagine being so like centered in your own ideas of what, how you are the only person who's oppressed based off of gender, that you don't even recognize that gender isn't real. Like, like, imagine, you know what I mean? Like, imagine. And I understand that this is a fairly quote unquote new concept.
It's not.
It's like it's been in the world for eons, like since people, because it's not real. It's like culturally, if I don't even understand how in culturally, if you look at other cultures, masculine and femininity are defined in so many different ways. So how therefore can gender be even a real thing? One, but if it took me realizing that she's so centered in her white womanness that she can't even recognize that there is more out there than misogyny. That they're literally thinking that the whole fight of the world is between man and woman. And I'm just like, oh, in the year of 2020.
The year of our Lord 2020.
If only that was the issue, right? Like, if only, what? But it's like, wow, how odd and how strange. And it took me realizing that's why she thinks she's some type of hero, because she really thinks that she's defending the woman's space from men entering it. Because if there are trans women, then now the woman is still like a marginalized group. And all of a sudden now men are entering women's spaces. And it's like, that's not even what it is. It's like,
it's not how gender works, Rowling.
Yeah. It's like y'all basic bitches, but it's like, but knowing that now that you, like being informed by that, we can actually have arguments and discussions from a different viewpoint, because it's like, Rowling, you do realize that there's more than misogyny out there. Like when you talk about it that way, it really makes someone stop and have to think like outside of their white womanness. Whereas right now, nobody's really confronting that. They're only confronting her views on gender. And well, they're so solid in their place because, I mean, historically, she's a boomer, one. And two, like, boomers can hardly wear PDS these days. So asking her to think that gender isn't real is like, it's a hard one because, I mean, like, she's been in the system for so long without it ever being challenged. So yeah. I don't know. That's just like my thing. That's nuance. Yeah. Like, that doesn't mean I'm giving her a pass at all. No. It just means that now we know how to actually talk to her about it. But you have to, like, try to understand.
But somebody needs to talk to her. Can somebody?
Please.
Like, white boomer feminist.
Give her my number.
Get your own.
Give her my number. Maybe I should make a video. And, like, hopefully one day it'll reach Scotland. She'll be like, click. No, the only black character. No, she had more than one black character in her book. But Angela, do you remember her? She was the girl where the only racism in her book was about Angela and her hair looking like snakes. And like, I think that was it. Like they made fun of her braids. And I was like, wow, the only legit real world racism in here is against a black girl. Wow. Well, okay. Rowling.
I think that Cho Chang's name in itself is an offensive name.
Yeah. She's, I mean, like the racism that's like in it because she is so like, she's just ignorant is abundant. But like, she literally wrote race like this moment of tension, and while everybody else is being called like a mudblood, she's like, "Oh, girl with your black braids, look like snakes." And I'm just like, "Wow, they couldn't even like come up with like a magical diss for her. She had to be pointed out for being black." Like, okay.
Well, I see you. You are clearly a fan of books, and I am a fan of your book. I am a fan of your BookTube, and I think that all fans of books should be fans of you and all of your work. So
thank you.
I have to, I could sit and talk to you for hours, seriously, but we have to wrap up. So we ask the same questions at the end. And the first one is, do you have a book to recommend that is not your own that you think our audience should check out?
I do. Actually, I have two. So one is by Amara Luciano. She writes, it's a series of novellas, and I'm actually so in love because it's like the new adult genre of fantasy, and she writes in such a poetic way, and it's so diverse in so many different ways, and it's a secondary fantasy world, but it's called The Heir of Fates, and it follows like four different women. And I don't know, like she builds worlds in such amazing ways for short stories, and I normally hate short stories. Like I am not a short story person, and I get so like enraptured by hers. And then second, I always have to shout out Svetlana Chamkova, and it's Chamkova. I love all of her graphic novels, especially her middle grade ones. She's got Awkward, Brave, and Crush. And First off, like, I was just so pleasantly surprised. I went into it not knowing anything. I just saw like a girl on the cover who was vaguely brown. I didn't know anything. And the first one was awkward. It's just about a girl who starts school for the first time. And she's like in the art club, and the science club and the art club kind of get into a tizzy fit while she's like trying to make a friend. And like, it's cute. It's interesting. It's fun. But it's also deep and like moving. And like, you get emotionally attached to these characters. But the thing that really got me was the casual diversity. Like, because they're in a middle school, I don't know why it touched me so much, because it was like, it wasn't there to make a point. It wasn't there to bring up like, they're diverse, but here's her struggle over here. It's like all these characters were just casually diverse. And it felt so much like what it was like growing up. I grew up in Orlando, Florida, and I went to a school with so many different people. And so I always say, I really understand casual diversity. It's when you sit in a class with someone, you really don't know anything about their culture. You just know the person. And they're different from you. And that's just it. Like, whether it's based out of ignorance or self-centeredness, you just don't care enough about like their culture. You just care about like them momentarily while you sit next to them having a joke about a teacher or something like that. And I loved that aspect of it, because it meant that these people were here to be seen, and that they are here, and they're not here for your educational purposes. They're not here for your like voyeurism. They're just here. That's it. Respect that. And I love all her stuff. She has like three in that series of like the little middle school, and then she's got like a fantasy one that I just read, which was really cool. So yeah, and plus the art is amazing.
We will leave links to all of those, plus smash it in the show notes. And if we want to connect further with you online, where is the best way to follow?
I am usually on Instagram now, but also my I say my YouTube channel. I post videos sparingly. It's only when I have something to say.
As you should. You shouldn't just make content just to make content, she says with a weekly podcast.
I feel like it's so hard for me to like consistently talk about stuff, because then I feel like I'm in a consistently negative space where I'm like, you know, nuance, and it's like I just want to live. But Instagram, I usually post on there. Sometimes I'm on my stories when I'm like feeling more like social and stuff like that. But yeah, I've gotten to a whole new like photographic phase of expressing myself via arts, visual arts. So yeah, Instagram.
Awesome. I will leave links to that too. Thank you so much, Francina. This has been so delightful.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature. Oh. A well-